chuckling teeth trying to get them to dance. And to hear their parents say that it sparked an interest in that, you know, was really great to hear. And then what else? What else was there? The good feedback. Oh, attendance. And I can say, yeah, attendance has improved. And I think a lot of that has to do with the 9 a.m. start. We've got less tardies. But we got some good actionable feedback from the parents during the community meeting. And so the way the meeting works is we talk about the challenges, you know, we broke apart into two groups and each one came up with what they thought maybe we needed from like district, teachers, parents, students. So like as a whole, what kind of things we needed to resolve. And then we shared it out in a group, went back out into our breakout groups and talked about what solutions we could have for it. So the meeting, you know, talks about the challenges, we get to the solutions, and then at the very end, we talk about how each person is able to support our solutions. So that is really helpful format. And then tomorrow, the 5th through 10th graders are going to be leaving for the fisheries trip, which I planned, which unfortunately I'm not able to go, but it was a lot of fun planning it, and I can't wait to hear about it. But they'll be going to, they'll go to Anchorage, then travel down to the southeast. They'll go to Juneau, where they will get a tour of the Capitol building. They'll get to meet with a couple of people on the fisheries committee, a couple of representatives on the fisheries committee, and they will be able to, when they go to Sitka, they'll go to the fish hatchery there, the aquarium, and I mean, there's a lot of stuff to do in Sitka, and that's going to be kind of like up to them once they get there, but the fish hatchery and the aquarium are scheduled for sure. And it's going to be the 10-day trip, and it looks like the weather's going to be good. I think it'll go well. And so with them going on their fisheries trip, I'm going to be here with my elementary students, and I didn't want them to miss out on all the fisheries activities, you know. So we planned, me and the parents of the kids that are staying, we're planning a little field trip over to Accoon where we can go tide pooling, and we are going to do some beach cleanup over there. And I have several fun art projects planned for once we get all the marine debris cleaned up, what we can do with that. And so that you should see that in my next report. And it included pictures from the swim trip. You know, we had 16 students, and 15 of those 16 passed their swim test. And the youngest of the ones that passed the swim test decided to swim in the swim meet. And she did, 25-yard freestyle, I think? 25-yard freestyle in like 37 seconds. That was a lot of fun. That was something that wasn't planned. We weren't planning to be there for that, but that was a great surprise. Do you have any questions about my report?
Sounds like no questions. Thank you for your report. Sounds like you guys had a good time.
Yeah, I was
jealous. I'm jealous. I miss our pool.
Yeah, definitely. They were done with it by the fourth day. Everybody's worst part of the trip was that they got chlorine rash. Their skin was not used to the chlorine.
Oh, yeah. Hey, thank you. Next up is Mr. Brown.
Good evening, everyone. I'm on a hotel Wi-Fi right now in Anchorage, so if I go out, just be prepared for that and just move on. But should be good. Okay, yeah, so I think there's been a lot of happy things for our school this past month, and the big highlight was our APICTA grant. And all the students built a real traditional kayak from start to finish. 3 weeks of hard work. So we brought in Mark Daniels and Christian Powell. Mark Daniels is like a head carpenter. He has a lot of experience with these types of projects, and Christian's younger, and I believe he has family in King Cove. That's what he said. And he was the assistant apprentice, and yeah, they did a great job. They really, the students loved working with them, and the students had lots of fun. And I thought it was a very educational experience for the kids, and there was lots of learning. We also brought in a cultural language person, Nikita. So there was also the language part, which was also fun and meaningful for the kids. So yeah, the kayak project went really well, and we got some testing done early in that process as well. And then a couple highlights in terms of the kayak project for the students was a field trip part. The kids have been asking me all year, when are we going to have a field trip? And basically, the field trip was we walked on the beach, and they were supposed to learn about different kinds of wood and understanding, the wood you would use in building a boat. And we got some great pictures from the field trip. On the last day, we did a boat launch, and our instructional assistant, Father Andre, who's also a a pastor at the local church, he blessed the boat, and I think it was a fun and great experience for the kids to actually see all this hard work that they did translate into riding it into the actual water. And we had kids actually riding the kayak, and it was kind of interesting because it's not as simple as you would seem. Like, you had to take off your shoes, and of course your water's going to get super cold, and there was a specific way on how you get in and how you get out. But yeah, the kids loved it. And one of our dads, Shane Hoblett, had the best idea, because we were talking about where are we going to put it. And Shane's idea was he's going to create a little spot in the gym on the wall up high that makes it easy to take it down and put it back in. So it's intended to be used. And Mark Daniels said that it's meant to be used, and it's not good if the boat's not being used. And I believe some of our students have a long-term interest in possibly participating in a competition in terms of riding these boats. And then yeah, the parents were so generous to show our appreciation for our guests. We had a wonderful potluck that night at the gym, and the parents cooked all this wonderful food. And yeah, so that was a lot of fun. Along with that, I think the two other big highlights is, we're wrapping up the school year here, and we've been doing a lot of preparation for the 25-26 school year. So we're going to finish the school year strong, but we're trying to do as much as we can to prepare for next fall. And I've already had conversations with parents and the students, about, what are things that went well this year, but what are things that can be improved upon. So we're definitely look. We want to get off to a fast start next fall. And also another Shane thing is, we did like three or four full truckloads of old curriculum, old supplies. So we just did a massive amount of decluttering. So we got to a school. The school building's at a very nice point in terms of its cleanliness and organization. We even found re report cards from when Shane, Nikki and Melanie were in school at False Pass. So that's how old we were finding stuff. Yeah, so that's all I got. But the last thing I'll say is I appreciate the parent teacher conferences, and really feel like I have a good collaborative, positive relationship with the parents, and they're very supportive to me. And yeah, we're all working together as a team to support the students.
Great, thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, next up is Dave Nielsen, the financial report.
Thank you, Madam President, members of the board, Superintendent Franklin. My report is in your packet, and I do not have anything to add at this time.
Thank you, Dave. Are there any questions for Dave? Hearing none, I would entertain a motion to accept the current financial report as presented.
I move to accept the current financial report as presented.
I'll second. This is Hillary.
Okay. I got Carla, Carlene for the motion, Carla for the second. Roll call.
Hillary?
Yes.
Amy?
Yes.
Carla?
Yes.
Carlene?
Yes.
Rita?
Yes.
Freya?
Yes.
Motion carries.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Dave. Department reports. Back to you, Matt.
Hi again. Reports in the packet. I'll say a couple quick things. Obviously, we've got basketball done. So NYO is going, and, you know, I really don't have much knowledge about NYO, so I'm excited to learn more about it. I see our false pass kids practicing every day, and I know how enthusiastic they are about NYO. So yeah, that's obviously a big highlight for our district this week with NYO and Anchorage. So I'll be here to support teams however I need to, and looking forward to learn, see what it's like. And then, yeah, I guess just a couple, two quick things is we've been working really hard on the activities handbook. Superintendent, district office, principals, myself. And I think next steps is, you know, Mike's doing some edits and he's going through the document. And I think in the upcoming weeks, we're going to be presenting a draft to the coaches, to the staff, to the board. You know, we can get feedback and input in terms of the athletics handbook. And, you know, I think a key point is that our goal, talking with Mike, one of our big goals is that we want to be very clear and we want to be consistent across the district. So everything pertaining from travel to eligibility, you know, to OSSA policies, our goal is to be transparent, clear, and to be consistent, to totally be on the same page. And by doing this, we hope to, you know, improve the student activity experience for coaches, students, parents, staff, and community. So that's coming up. And we've also started the process with creating the student activities calendar for next year. So it's a goal to have a draft ready for the May school board meeting.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for Matt? Next is technology report, Austin.
Hey, good evening, everyone. My report is in the packet. Be happy to take any questions anyone might have about it.
All right. Any questions? Okay, hearing none. Thank you. New business, second reading of the 2026 budget. For Mike.
Dave, were there any revisions from the?
Thank you, Madam President. And there were just a few adjustments based on information that was gathered from the first reading, and we actually were able to reduce the deficit a little bit. So it's just under 200,000, which we can easily cover with a fund transfer. So the budget in the second reading form is balanced and is essentially the same with just a few minor adjustments here and there as the first reading.
Are there any questions for Dave? Okay, I'd entertain a motion to put the budget on the table for the second reading.
I move to put the budget on the table for the second reading.
I'll second.
Motion by Carla, second by Amy. Roll call.
Rita?
Yes.
Carlene?
Yes.
Hillary?
Yes.
Freya?
Yes.
Amy?
Yes.
Carla?
Yes.
Motion carries.
There's no discussion. Budget, right? Do we adopt the budget now?
No,
not until next meeting?
I think after the second meeting. I think it shows, if you look at the document, the first page of Dave's document, it shows the process.
It shows it could be done tonight's meeting, but the date is just needs to be adjusted, that it's the 22nd and not the 16th.
I mean, that's just the date you made it up. I mean, the adoption takes place after the 2nd.
Is there a motion to adopt the 2026 budget? Oh, wait. We just roll called all that. Okay. Is there a motion to adopt the budget?
I move to adopt the 2026 budget.
I'll second this, Carlene.
Motion by Carla, second by Carlene. Roll call.
Amy?
Yes.
Project loud.
Yes.
Carla?
Yes.
Rita?
Yes.
Freya?
Yes.
Carlene?
Yes.
Motion carries.
Okay, thank you. B is the AEBSD scholarships. Like, we have how many?
21.
21 scholarships. Do you know what the amount is?
There were two that still needed a
the acceptance letter.
Yeah.
They have everything else. They're just as pending.
If they don't send that information, they won't receive a scholarship.
Okay.
$1,667
a piece.
Yeah, just about. It's just a few cents under that.
Okay. Is there a motion to approve scholarships for? I'm just gonna read them.
I don't know if we need a motion.
Yeah, this is information.
I don't think we made a motion before for this one. I can check last year.
Did a motion to approve the number, and then they released the names at graduation.
Perfect.
Could you say the amount of the total of the scholarship was again, just the lump sum amount, not how much
each
kid would get?
$66.66.
$1,666.66.
I'll go out on that Monday. Yeah. I'll need to go up for that one.
It's $35,000 divided by the 21.
$35,000?
Yeah, that's AEB that donates that.
Thank you.
Okay.
I move to approve $1,666.62. Was that 66
it? 66 cents.
1,666.66.
Yeah.
For 21 students for the 2025 scholarships.
I'll second.
Okay. Motion by Carlene, second by Amy. Roll call.
Rhea?
Yes.
Carla?
Yes.
Amy?
Yes.
Hillary?
Yes.
Carlene?
Yes.
Rita?
Abstain.
Motion carries.
Okay, next up is Resolution 2025-2 ABT Participation in Alaska Public Risk Alliance. Dave, are you still there?
Yes, thank you, Madam President. This resolution is coming as a result of AMLJIA, which we've been a member of for decades. They have merged with another municipal league or municipal association to form a new insurance alliance. And in order for us to become a member of the new alliance, we need a resolution from the board to officially be accepted by the new alliance group.
All right. Is there a motion to approve the resolution 2025-2.
Move to approve resolution 2025-2.
I'll second.
All right, roll call.
Amy?
Yes.
Rita?
Yes.
Rhea?
Yes.
Carlene?
Yes.
Hillary?
Yes.
Carla?
Yes.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Dave. Right. Next is the AEBSD and AEEA negotiated agreement. Everybody should have a copy. Entertain a motion to move into executive session to review the agreement.
I'll move to go into executive session to discuss the matters of the immediate knowledge of which would clearly have an adverse effect upon finances to the public entity, including review of the proposed 2025 through 2028 negotiated agreements between the AEBSD and the AEEA. With an invitation with Mike.
Ms. Carlene, a second.
Roll call.
Hillary?
Yes.
Carla?
Yes.
Carlene?
Yes.
Rita?
Yes.
Amy?
Yes.
Rhea?
Yes.
Motion carries.
You have paper that's easier.
Paper copies. Let's put these are Corwin.
Are we going to move for them if everyone comes?
No, you have to because there's. Hey, left.
All right, everyone, we have gone into the school board we, the royal we, have gone into executive session to discuss some personnel issues. I will check and see if they're going to be in there for a long time. If not, then, we will come back and bring you live coverage of their meeting once we're done with the executive session. In the meantime, how about a little Weezer?
My girls are liar, but I'll stand beside. This message comes from Capital One. The Capital One Venture X business card earns unlimited double miles on every purchase. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/VentureXBusiness.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies. In the 2024 presidential campaign, Democrats' warnings that American democracy was in jeopardy if Donald Trump was elected failed to persuade a majority of voters. Our guest, Stephen Levitsky, says there's plenty of reason to worry about our democracy now. Levitsky isn't a politician or a political pundit. He's a Harvard professor of government who spent much of his career studying democracy and dictatorship and how healthy democracies can slide into authoritarianism. He was last on Fresh Air to talk about the book he co-authored with Daniel Ziblatt titled How Democracies Die. In a new article for the journal Foreign Affairs, Levitsky and co-author Lucan A. Way write, quote, U.S. democracy will likely break down during the second Trump administration, in the sense that it will cease to meet standard criteria for a liberal democracy, full adult suffrage, free and fair elections, and broad protection of civil liberties, unquote. We've invited Levitsky here to explain the threats he sees to democracy and to talk about dramatic developments in the Trump administration's confrontation with Harvard University. Stephen Levitsky is director of the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard. He's also senior fellow at the Kettering Foundation and a senior democracy fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Besides the book How Democracies Die, Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt co-authored the 2023 book Tyranny of the Minority. We recorded our interview yesterday. Well, Stephen Levitsky, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
You note in this article that Freedom House, which is a nonprofit that's been around for a long time, which produces an annual global freedom index, has reduced the United States rating. It has slipped from 2014 to 2021. How much? Where are we now and where did we used to be?
Freedom House's scores range from 0, which is the most authoritarian, to 100, which is the most democratic, I think. A couple of Scandinavian countries get scores of 99 or 100. The U.S. for many years was in the low 90s, which put it broadly on par with other Western democracies like the U.K. and Italy and Canada and Japan. But it slipped in the last decade from Trump's first victory to Trump's second victory from the low 90s to 83, which placed us below Argentina and in a tie with Romania and Panama. So we're still above what scholars would consider a democracy, but now in the very low-quality democracy range, comparable, again, to Panama, Romania, and Argentina.
And does Freedom House explain its demotion? Why did this happen?
Oh, yeah. Freedom House has annual reports for every country. The rise in political violence, political threats, threats against politicians, refusal to accept the results of a democratic election in 2020, an effort to use violence to block a peaceful transfer of power are all listed among the reasons for why the United States has fallen. I should say that even in the first 4 months of the Trump administration, it's quite certain that what's happening on the ground in the United States is likely to bring the U.S. score down quite a bit.
You say that the danger here is not that the United States will become a classic dictatorship with sham elections, you know, opposition leaders arrested, exiled, and or killed. What kind of autocracy might we become?
I think the most likely outcome is a slide into what Lucan Way and I call competitive authoritarianism. These are regimes that constitutionally continue to be democracies. There is a constitution, there are regular elections, a legislature. And importantly, the opposition is legal, above ground, and competes for power. So from a distance, if you squint, it looks like a democracy. But the problem is that systematic accompanying abuse of power tilts the playing field against the opposition. This is the kind of regime that we saw in Venezuela under Hugo Chavez. It's subsequently become a full-on dictatorship. It's what we see in Turkey under Erdogan. It's what we see in El Salvador. It's what we see in Hungary today. Most new autocracies that have emerged in the 21st century have been led by elected leaders and fall into this category of competitive authoritarianism. It's kind of a hybrid regime.
So free and fair elections lead us to a leader which takes us in a different direction.
Right. And because the leader is
usually freely and fairly elected, he has a certain legitimacy that allows him to say, hey, how can you say I'm an authoritarian if I was freely and fairly elected? So citizens are often slow to realize that their country is descending into authoritarianism.
It's interesting that you say that no democracy is entirely free of politicization of these tools, and that that was the case in the United States in recent decades, true?
Yeah, it was much more so prior to Watergate. Again, throughout history, there, you can always find cases of certainly politicization, people using government agencies either to help their friends or to help their party. No democracy has ever been completely free of that. In the United States, there were lots of it, particularly at the local and state level, but even at the federal level, the use occasionally of the IRS to go after presidents' political enemies, the use of the FBI to spy on sometimes political rivals, more often political activists, usually on the left or in the civil rights movement, notoriously in the mid-20th century. So this, some of the stuff is not new. But after Watergate, which was one of the most sort of notorious case of a president actually getting caught engaging in this sort of weaponization, there were a series of reforms that pretty dramatically limited the politicization of key government agencies and ushered in what I consider far and away the United States' most democratic era. Between 1974 and 2016, there was very little weaponization of the state.
You know, it's interesting. I read in some of the recent reporting that in the U.S. Criminal Code, it is expressly prohibited, it is unlawful for the president or the vice president or any member of their executive staff to directly or indirectly suggest that the IRS audit or investigate a particular taxpayer, right? I mean, in theory, this can't be done.
It's also a violation of the rules for the president to order the Justice Department to investigate critics or people he doesn't like. And Trump just issued an executive order instructing the DOJ to investigate former Trump administration officials Miles Taylor and Christopher Krebs. Taylor was the author of the so-called anonymous op-ed in 2018, which stated that there were, in effect, adults in the room who were aware of the danger posed by Trump within the Trump administration and who were working to constrain him. And after leaving the government, Taylor became a vocal critic of the Trump administration. And Christopher Krebs was in charge of cybersecurity in the 2020 election, did a, by really all accounts, an extraordinarily effective job of ensuring that the 2020 election went off relatively smoothly. His crime, in air quotes, was contradicting President Trump and declaring that there was no significant fraud in the 2020 election. And for that, he is now the target or will be the target of a DOJ investigation.
You know, it struck me that it's one thing to say you're going to prosecute someone you don't like, but I wonder if it'll actually happen. I mean, you do have to find a provision of the federal criminal code that has been violated and make a case to convince a jury, right? This isn't really so easy, is it?
Well, conviction is not easy. We still have a very powerful and a quite independent judiciary. And so it's pretty unlikely that any of these cases will end up with the target landing in prison, at least as things stand now. But that doesn't prevent the FBI from investigating folks and the DOJ charging people with what may be dubious, difficult to prove crimes, or what may be very petty, meaningless infraction of the rule. Almost certainly these charges won't end up with the target in jail, but you can force targeted individuals to spend a lot of money lawyering up. You can force them to take a lot of time away from their job or to be distracted from their job, in some cases to have to leave their job. And you can cost them and their families months, sometimes years, of anguish and lost sleep. So you can do a lot of damage. You can do a lot to harass and to punish your critics, even if you fall short of putting them in prison.
You also write about how elected governments can slide towards autocracy. And one of the things that they do is find ways to get private actors, particularly corporations, on their side. To what extent are we seeing this in the Trump term?
We're seeing a lot. It turns out that government agencies, nominally independent and fair government agencies, regulatory agencies in particular, have a lot of power over businesses and other organizations' ability to make money or to do their jobs, to operate, whether it is tax-exempt status, whether it is anti-monopoly rulings, whether it is access to government contracts, government concessions, critical waivers from regulations. High-level bureaucrats have a lot of say over major CEOs or major companies' ability to continue to make money over their profit margins. And that's why it's so important that these agencies be independent of the executive branch, that they not be political loyalists who are doing political work for the executive. But if the executive weaponizes these agencies, whether it's the SEC or the FCC, they can turn into not only weapons to punish, say, businesses or media companies they don't like, but to induce them to cooperate. So if there are, you know, millions, billions of dollars at stake, and businesses know that key regulatory decisions are going to be made with politics in mind, then businesses and CEOs are going to behave accordingly. They're going to cooperate with their government. They're going to try to get on better terms with the government. That is exactly what we saw with Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos is not known to be a Trump supporter. Mark Zuckerberg, other major CEOs who very, very publicly gave money to Trump's inauguration, showed up very publicly at Trump's inauguration, praised Trump because they know that politics is now suddenly behind key regulatory and business decisions that affect their bottom line.
There are countervailing forces in this trend that you note towards authoritarianism. You say in this article that Trump is unlikely to consolidate authoritarian rule in his term. Why do you say that?
Well, studying democratic backsliding, studying authoritarian turns in other countries, we've learned that there are certain things that make it more or less likely that autocrats will succeed in the long run in establishing an autocracy like, say, Putin did in Russia or Chavez and Maduro did in Venezuela. Those are consolidated autocracies. Two factors that matter a lot. One is the popularity of the president. A president with an 80% approval rating, 75 or 80% approval rating, like, say, Bukele in El Salvador, like Hugo Chavez had, like Modi had for a while in India, can do much, much more damage than a president with 40, 45% approval rating. That's not fully prohibitive, but it helps to slow down the degree to which an autocrat can consolidate power. But more importantly than that, the degree of what I would call organizational and financial muscle in society matters a lot. It's much easier to consolidate an autocracy in countries with a pretty small private sector, with a weakly organized, maybe fragmented opposition, and with a relatively underdeveloped civil society. The United States has none of those things. The United States has a very large, very wealthy, very diverse private sector. You know, even with people like Zuckerberg and Bezos kind of moving to the political sidelines, there are still hundreds of other billionaires in the United States, and there are literally millions of millionaires in the United States. There's a lot of money out there in society. There are a lot of organizations with high-powered lawyers out there in society. There are many, many well-organized foundations and civic organizations. And the opposition, for all of its flaws, the Democratic Party represents a unified, well-organized, well-financed, electorally viable opposition. So compared to societies elsewhere, our civil society and our opposition is pretty well-equipped to resist Trump.
I wanted to talk about what's happened at Harvard University, your employer, which, you know, became a leader in the opposition to Trump recently. When the university refused to comply with the list of demands from the administration, and the administration responded by freezing $2.2 billion in federal grants. Let's just talk about this for a moment. The letter that the administration sent to Harvard a week ago Friday, that's April 11th, is a pretty remarkable letter. I just read this over the weekend. I wanted to cite a passage here. This is a part of the letter that deals with Harvard's apparent imbalance in viewpoint diversity, according to the administration, obviously underrepresenting conservatives. But here's what the text of the letter says. By August 25, the university shall commission an external party which shall satisfy the federal government as to its competence and good faith to audit the student body, faculty, staff, and leadership for viewpoint diversity, such that each department, field, or teaching unit must be individually viewpoint diverse. This review shall begin no later than this summer and shall be submitted to the university and the federal government by the end of the year. Harvard must abolish all criteria, preferences, and practices, whether mandatory or optional, throughout its admissions and hiring practices that function as ideological litmus tests. Every department or field found to lack viewpoint diversity must be reformed by hiring a critical mass of new faculty within that department or field who will provide viewpoint diversity. That's a pretty remarkable thing for a government to demand of a university, isn't it?
What that passage is saying is that the government is demanding the right to dictate to a private university who it can hire and not hire, and effectively what it can teach and cannot teach. That's the end of academic freedom. That is completely incompatible with a democratic society. And I know of no democracy that's ever permitted that sort of intervention. I know of many authoritarian regimes that didn't permit that level of federal intervention into the internal life of a university.
I'm wondering what role, if any, you might have played in urging the administration of Harvard to take the position it did. I think you wrote an open letter with Ryan Enos, is that right?
Yes. Ryan Enos and I wrote a series of columns in the Crimson that were pretty widely diffused, and we organized a letter signed by 800 faculty members calling on the administration, one, to publicly denounce attacks on other universities. We found it unconscionable that other university leaders were silent when Columbia first came under attack. We called on the university to refuse to acquiesce to the kinds of demands that you just read. And we called on the university in the letter to work with other universities to try to build an opposition to these attacks. What the current administration is doing is a deliberate effort, an authoritarian effort, and an illegal effort, I should add, to weaken universities, which is something that autocrats do really almost invariably. Autocrats of the left, like Hugo Chavez, autocrats of the right, like Erdogan and Orban, invariably go after universities, and that is precisely what the Trump administration is doing. So there are a number of reasons why the university ultimately said no to the Trump administration's demands. But faculty are really concerned, particularly those of us who not only teach here, but who study authoritarianism and have seen these kinds of assaults elsewhere.
You know, there was some reporting over the weekend, this is pretty wild, that suggested that the government's letter, which made these extensive demands of Harvard to eliminate DEI and change the balance of its faculty in terms of their ideological point of views, that that letter may have been sent by mistake. What do you make of this? I mean, the administration has not backed down. It's not said that the letter is inoperable.
I think that the administration blinked. I think it realized that this was not going well. Harvard's resistance gave a real burst of energy and encouragement, not just to other universities, but to civil society across the country that's been waiting for the more powerful actors, the more prominent actors in our society to get off the sidelines and begin to fight back. I know that Harvard's leadership was concerned that Harvard's public image is not great right now, it's viewed as very elitist, and that there was a concern that the public would rally behind Trump against Harvard if there was such a conflict. That did not happen. To the extent that anybody rallied, the public rallied and was beginning to rally behind Harvard. And I think the administration realized that this fight was not going well and wanted to reset the negotiations. And I think they realized that they asked too much. And the danger now is that they'll come back and offer or demand 60% of what they demanded before. And I don't know what the university's response will be.
Stephen Levitsky is a professor of government at Harvard and co-author with Lucan Way of a new article in the journal Foreign Affairs titled The Path to American Authoritarianism. After we recorded our interview yesterday, news broke that Harvard had sued the Trump administration over its announced funding cuts, accusing the government of violating the First Amendment by seeking to control what Harvard teaches its students. We contacted Levitsky to get his reaction. He said, quote, "I'm very pleased to see Harvard leading by example. The most powerful among us must lead the way," unquote. A White House spokesman said in a statement that taxpayer funds are a privilege and Harvard fails to meet the basic conditions to access that privilege. We'll hear more of our interview with Stephen Levitsky after this short break. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
This message comes from Capella University. The right support can make a difference. That's why at Capella University, learning online doesn't mean learning alone. You'll get support from people who care about your success and are there for you every step of the way. Whether you're working on a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, you can learn confidently knowing you'll get the dedicated help you need. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu.
This message comes from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting On Swift Horses, starring Daisy Edgar-Jones, Jacob Elordi, Will Poulter, Diego Calva, and Sasha Calle. Muriel and her husband Lee are beginning a new life when he returns from the Korean War. But when Lee's brother arrives, a dangerous love triangle quickly forms. Muriel's longing for something more propels her into a secret life, exploring a love she never dreamed possible. On Swift Horses opens April 25th only in theaters. Get tickets now at onswifthorses.com. This message comes from LinkedIn Ads. Target your buyers by job title, company, role, and skills with LinkedIn Ads. All the professionals you need to reach in one place. Get a $100 credit on your next campaign at linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply.
We've been talking about some of the troubling signs that you see since the second Trump administration was inaugurated. One thing we haven't talked a lot about is other Republicans. In your book, The Tyranny of the Minority, you write about politicians who are semi-loyal to democracy. That is to say, they believe in it or apparently believe in it, but tend to be quiet when it is attacked. What's the state of the Republican Party? What's its role in all of this?
I think the Republican Party has a crucial and really underappreciated role in all of this. It would be pretty easy to put the brakes on what the Trump administration is doing. It would only take a handful of Republicans. It would not take a majority of Republicans. It wouldn't even take a large faction of Republicans could change the dynamic and put the brakes on what is a pretty radical authoritarian turn in the last 4 months. But the party now sort of purged of its last Adam Kinzinger's and Liz Cheney's, is almost uniform in backing an openly authoritarian figure, or at least acquiescing to an openly authoritarian figure. And unlike 2016, 17, there's no serious debate about Donald Trump's authoritarianism. He openly attempted to overturn the results of an election, and he tried to block a peaceful transfer of presidential power. The fact that the Republican Party, knowing that their leader attempted a coup, would nominate him and would give him the blank check that they have given him, in the sense of allowing him to place somebody like Kash Patel in charge of the FBI, and allow to basically abdicate authority while the president engages in illegal behavior and appropriating congressionally approved funds, is shocking to me, even though I wrote those words a couple of years ago in Tyranny of the Minority. It's astounding to me how far mainstream Republicans are willing to go to avoid a conflict with Trump, and how far they're willing to sacrifice democracy in order to preserve their jobs or their social standing.
You know, in an interview with The New Republic, I read that you said that if Trump were to refuse to obey, to openly violate the law and potentially not comply with judicial orders, judicial rulings, saying that you're in violation of the law, that that's really outside of this competitive authoritarianism. You said that's the realm of outright dictatorship. And I wonder how close are we to that right now? I mean, the Supreme Court ordered the administration to facilitate the return of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the Maryland man who was, according to the administration, mistakenly arrested and transported to that prison in El Salvador. The administration's claiming now that he's in the custody of El Salvador and they can't bring him back. Isn't the administration, in effect, defying an order of the Supreme Court here?
In effect, it is. However, I think there's always a lot of ambiguity, a lot of gray area when it comes to whether or not the administration is openly challenging or disobeying the court. Both sides have an interest in avoiding the appearance of outright violation of court orders. And